This message is a presentation of Pinnacle Baptist Church and the preaching ministry of Pastor Ray McBerry. Other messages like this are available online at pinnaclebaptist.com. The church is located at 2517 High Falls Road in Griffin, Georgia. If you're in the area, we would love for you to visit us this Sunday. Now, here's today's message.
All right, well, tonight we are in the final chapter of the book of Ephesians. We've made it through the first five chapters, and we've not rushed through the first five chapters. In fact, the first chapter, we spent, I believe, 4 weeks together there. And so we're not rushing through it, but last week we actually finished all of chapter 5 in 1 week. And this evening we'll see if we can do the same thing with chapter number 6, so that when we come back after the Thanksgiving holiday, the following Sunday evening, we'll begin a brand new book of the prison epistles that we're studying here in the New Testament. So tonight we're in Ephesians chapter 6. Now we saw at the end of chapter number 5, Paul was dealing with the relationships between husbands and wives. If you missed that, it's online. You can go back and listen to that. If you need me to, I'll send you the link to it. But what we're going to see as we continue with chapter number 6, we're going to see the Apostle Paul deal with several other types of relationships. But I want you to keep in mind that in all these relationships he's discussing, he is speaking to believers. He's talking to Christians. And bear that in mind as we go through here. So in the end of chapter 5, he dealt with the relationship of husbands and wives. I'll put this on the whiteboard, and then we'll come back to that a little bit later. All right, beginning in verse 1 of chapter 6, Paul says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right." So now we see he's beginning to talk to another set of relationships, children and parents. And he specifically, in verse 1, addresses children. He says, "Obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right." You know, there are a lot of young people of every generation since the Garden of Eden until now that have had a problem with obeying parents, and obeying parents specifically because they're in authority, and the culture in which we live has done nothing but aggravate this natural problem that already exists of children wanting to be rebellious when they reach a certain age in particular. But Paul says, "Obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right." What do you think he means when he says, "in the Lord"? Alex?
Keep themselves under what the Lord has them do, then it's right, so you should always obey that.
Okay, so Alex is referencing back to something we talked about last week, that in the home, if the parents are under, if they're in submission to the Lord, then the children should be in submission to the parents. And keep in mind that even though our Bible in the English language here is broken down into chapters, Paul's original writing to the church there at Ephesus was not broken into chapters. So this was just a continuation of the same letter. And he just got finished talking about husbands and wives and the proper hierarchy of authority in the home. And so right under the parents comes the children. And so Alex is right when he says, "in the Lord," he's saying, in keeping with that same hierarchy, the parents are to be under the authority of the Lord, and the children are under the authority of the parents because they're in submission to Christ. Now, let me ask you a question then. In a home where the parents are not believers, do children who get saved either in Sunday school or Christian school or the neighbor down the street witnessed to him in whatever way, if the child is a Christian, but the parents are not Christians, is the child still expected by God to be in obedience to the parents? Well, yes. The answer to that, hopefully the obvious answer, is yes. Because whether the parents are saved or not, they are still that child's parents, and they're the parents that God gave that child and put the child under those parents. So it is not specifically the person in every case that is the reason the child should be in obedience. It's because that is the position of authority that God placed in the child's life. God placed the child under his or her parents, and that's the authority God has placed in their lives. Now, the obvious exception to that would be if the parents, saved or lost, are trying to get the child to do something that is a sin, to do something that is wrong. And sadly enough, in the world in which we live, there are parents who from time to time do try to get their children to do things that are wrong. In fact, I heard a story just this past week about a young man who's now a young adult, and it was his own parents that got him started doing drugs in the first place, of all things. It's a sad world in which we live, but when Paul says, obey your parents in the Lord, I think it's number one what Alex said. Obey your parents because you're under their authority, as long as they're not telling you to do something that's unbiblical, that's a violation of biblical scripture. By the way, it would be the same thing in the relationship between a husband and a wife. Paul said the wife is to be in submission to her own husband, but if the husband is trying to get the wife to do something that is outside the scope of scripture, that is a violation of biblical principles, he has no authority to tell her or ask her or command her to violate biblical principles. Neither would a parent have the right to command their child to violate biblical principles either. But children, as a general rule, should obey their parents, for this is right. Look at verse 2. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee, and thou mayest live long on the earth. So a couple of things here in these two verses. He says here, honor thy father and mother. Now he's already said, children, obey your parents in the Lord. Is there a difference between obeying and honoring our parents? There is a difference. Anybody beside Alex want to take a stab at this one? What's the difference between obeying and honoring?
Where it's obeyed, a slave can obey a master, and not necessarily, there be no love or respect.
Okay. So honor would convey some sort of reverence or respect for the person in authority there. I think that's a good point, Brother Mike. Do you want to say something else, Brother Alex? Is that pretty much what you were going to say?
Yeah. And the children don't bring shame.
And the children should not bring shame to the family. That's a good point, too. So honoring, it certainly would include obedience, but it probably includes more than just following the letter of the law. I mean, just cleaning your room when you're told to clean your room, you can do that, and that is obedience, but it's not necessarily all that's included with honoring your father and mother. There's some respect and reverence that should be present also if you're going to truly honor your father and mother. The other thing in these verses is that Paul is actually referencing something from the Old Testament. What passage of the Old Testament is the Apostle Paul referencing here? The Ten Commandments. That's exactly right. If you want to hold your place where we are in Ephesians and turn back in the Old Testament, does anybody know what chapter of the Old Testament we find the Exodus 20? Okay, so if you're in our adult Sunday school class, then very, very shortly we're going to be coming up on Mount Sinai and the giving of the Ten Commandments. So we're going to see this in Sunday school, but if you want to turn back and look at it briefly, it's Exodus chapter 20, verse 12. Here's what the Bible says way back there when God gave Moses the Ten Commandments. Honor thy father and thy mother. And then it has a colon. Now, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago here in our study in Ephesians. A colon is different than a semicolon. A semicolon is just kind of a conjunction. It's the same as the word and. It's used for joining two sentences together. A colon joins two sentences together, but it implies that what comes after the colon is an explanation of what came before the colon. So in this sentence, in Exodus chapter 20, verse number 12, God said, "Honor thy father and thy mother, colon, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee." So back in the Ten Commandments, when God says, honor your father and mother, He gives a promise that if you do those things, what will be true? You live long. Now, I know some Christian young people that were perhaps some of the most godly children I've ever known that for one reason or another, due to a car accident or a sickness or some other tragedy, they passed away at a young age. Okay, I'm thinking more children age at this point. But you could be right, Brother Mike, young adult even. We're not saying that young people who pass away at a young age were not honoring their father and mother. But the general principle that's being taught is that if you do honor your father and mother, you will live a longer life than you would have had you not honored your father and mother. So this is a command. It's listed in the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20, but it contains a promise. You know, most of the time, if you have a set of rules you have to follow, it's just a set of rules to follow. But this is one that there's a rule to follow, a command in particular, but it also gives you a promise that if you do keep the command, you get a bonus for following the command. Brother Vinny?
Also, you look back in the Old Testament, if you hurt or disrespect your parent, the elders of the area took you out to each town and stoned you to death.
That is true. One of the penalties for being disrespectful to parents was the child being stoned to death. That does not mean that if they did it one time, they were taken out and stoned, but a habitual lifestyle of being disobedient and disrespectful to parents, Brother Vinny's right, the child would have been stoned. They didn't have too much problem with children being disrespectful, at least outwardly, back in the old days of Israel. It just wasn't a big problem, and you can see why, I think. But now back to our study in Ephesians chapter number 6, Paul specifically, he quotes the commandment from the Ten Commandments, from Exodus 20, and he says in verse 3, that it may be well with thee, and thou mayest live long on the earth. So he's referencing not only the command that children should honor their father and mother, but that there's a promise that goes with it. By the way, it doesn't matter how old you are, how old you get, you've still got a mother and father. You can still be an honor to your mother and father, whether they're alive or already with the Lord, or you can be a dishonor to your parents today, whether they're still alive or whether they're with the Lord. So we can all still either honor our father and mother today or be a dishonor to our father and mother today. Verse number 4, "And ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord." So let's take this verse and break it into two parts here. The first part says, fathers, don't provoke your children to wrath. What does that mean? How can a father provoke his child to wrath?
Beat on them every move they make. Fussing at them.
Okay. Staying on them about everything, Uncle Milton says. I think that's good. Anybody want to add to that?
Ever drink beer while he's drinking a beer. I mean, you could provide an example of that. There's a million other examples, drugs.
So the parents can say, do as I say, not as I do. Yeah, I think that's a good example. Alex?
Yeah, I think also it could be that if they, display wrath in front of them, even if it's not Adam, that would
okay.
Force the kid to be that way.
Providing a bad example of wrath and losing your temper. Jerry?
Like the father's pretty mean guy to everybody, and he wants his child to be the same. There's that problem I've seen since I was a child.
Okay? So the father setting a bad example and encouraging the child to do that. You know, it's possible to discipline our children and be right in what we're saying, but still do it in such a way that it makes them not want to obey. Isn't that the truth? And the word, it's interesting because the word discipline comes from the same root word as disciple. And when we as parents are disciplining our children, what we are supposed to be doing is discipling our children. We're not supposed to just be meting out some set punishment for whatever act they committed that was wrong, but we're supposed to be helping them get back to where they should be. Not only outwardly in obedience, but inwardly in the heart. A parent that is just forcing compliance on the outside without caring what the child's heart is on the inside is setting the parents and the child up for some bad days ahead down the road. So even as, you know, even if we correct our children and what we say is the right thing, we can still do it in a way that's causing them to have a wrong attitude on the inside. We should be teaching them, guiding, nurturing them so that we're leading them to Jesus. If it's before they know Christ, our discipline should be leading them to the foot of the cross. And if they're already saved, then our discipline should be leading them to have a personal relationship with Him. And again, our testimony and how we live in front of them certainly all plays into that. Just so everything you all said is part of that. Showing them the right way, even when we're disciplining them. Not provoking them to wrath. Not making them be rebellious by the way we correct them, but correcting them in love. Correcting them with the right example as well. All right, so we have seen in the end of chapter 5, the relationship of husbands and wives. And we won't go back and reteach the whole section. You can go back and listen to it if you want to later on. But Paul says clearly the same thing that the Lord said in the Old Testament, that wives are supposed to be in submission to their own husbands, not everybody else's husband, but their own husband. So there is an established authority in the home. As we talked about last week, the wives are not supposed to be mistreated. The husband's supposed to treat the wife better than himself. And if he does that, she won't have nearly as big a problem being submissive to her husband if she knows he's putting her well-being before his own. But it's still that relationship of an authority and someone in submission, husbands and wives. Here we have parents, particularly fathers, but we could say parents in general, and children. And it's the same thing. There's an authority figure, parents, and then there's the children who are to be in submission to their own parents. The world today is promoting in every way possible the destruction of the hierarchy of authority that God has created in every sphere of life. Satan wants to destroy America. He wants to destroy any society that has biblical values in place. Traditionally, American society has always recognized the authority and the submission role in each sphere of life. Satan wants to undermine that. Create chaos, confusion, rebellion. I mean, let's face it, the world today tells wives, you don't have to be in submission to your husband. In fact, if you watch anything on coming out of Hollywood or whatever, they don't even talk about wives being in submission to their husbands anymore, to honor and obey your husband when you take your wedding vows. They don't talk about that anymore. No, because the world is trying to disrupt turn upside down the established order that God created. We talked about some of the biblical reasons why God made the husband not only the head of the wife, but the protector of the wife. Same thing with the parents and children. Satan has been trying since the Garden of Eden to get children to be rebellious to their parents. But he's turned it up a notch in the last couple of decades. I think about even the music that came out in the 60s and 70s and all since then. All of that worldly secular music is intended to put children at odds with their parents, to flip that paradigm upside down, to encourage rebellion. Why? Because these at the top, these that are the authority figures that God created, are not only supposed to be keeping order, but they're for the protection of those under their charge. And if God can, I mean, if Satan can mess that arrangement up, why, there's nobody protecting anybody in the entire society. The entire culture will collapse and fall apart, and Satan can just have his pickings of what he wants. That's what he's trying to do to our culture. Now, let's continue on here. We're about to see another relationship, and this one is even more politically incorrect than what the preacher preached on this morning. But Paul addresses it head on. Verse number 5, servants, be obedient to them that are your masters, according to the flesh, with fear and trembling, in singleness of your heart, as unto Christ. Now that word servants, we've talked about this word before. What does this word servant mean? Does anybody remember the Greek word for it? Doulos, that's right, Brother Mike. The word is doulos. And in some places, our English Bible translates it servant. In other places, what else does it translate? Slave. Now, at the day and time in which Paul is writing, slaves were a normal, everyday part of society. And they have been in human society all the way up to today. There are slaves in different parts of the world, even to this day, in spite of what you might be led to believe. Especially today in Muslim countries. Paul, in none of his writings in the New Testament, seeks to do away with, abolish the institution of slavery. In the Old Testament, the children of Israel were given very specific commands by God that if they took slaves or indentured servants, either foreigners or their own countrymen, these are the rules you had to follow. You could have foreigners as slaves, you could have some of your own countrymen as indentured servants. There's really not a whole lot of difference there. But the Old Testament gave very specific rules from God that you had to follow if you had servants or slaves. In spite of what the liberals would have you to believe, and the revisionist historians and revisionist Bible scholars today would have us to believe, there is no passage even in the New Testament after Christ came where Jesus, Paul, nor anybody else in the New Testament sought to abolish the institution of slavery. The liberals in our society would have you to believe that when Christianity showed up, Christianity is against slavery. It's not expressed anywhere in the pages of this New Testament. But what is expressed is that slaves were to be in subjection to their masters. Paul said, according to the flesh. That is, they're your masters in the flesh. That doesn't mean they're your masters spiritually. It doesn't mean they have control over your soul, but in the flesh, they're your masters. So if they're your masters in this body, in the flesh, what does he say to do? He says, be obedient to them. And he doesn't just say be obedient to them. He says, be obedient to them as unto Christ. Ouch. Yikes. Wow. That's totally different than what you're going to hear on from New York, Hollywood, Washington, or the curly-headed preacher on television.
Well, they talk about getting stoned in the street, dropping that across to the general public.
Yeah, that's right. It would not be well received to say this even among Christians today, because Christians are ignorant of their Bible and ignorant of the principles that God was trying to teach through the pages of this Bible. So that third relationship we've got after husbands and wives, parents and children, is masters and slaves or servants. Paul does not say that God commands slaves to rise up and revolt and rebel against your masters. For slavery is an evil institution. He didn't say that. I mean, you might feel that way, but Paul didn't say that. Jesus didn't say that. There's no Bible to back up that belief. It's not in this book. What he does say is if you're a slave, obey your master in the flesh. Did it say if you like him, obey him? Nope. If he's a Christian, obey him? Nope. Paul didn't even say he had to be a Christian to obey him. He just says if he's your master according to the flesh, obey him. Look what else he says in verse 6. Not with eye service as men pleasers, but as the servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, with good will doing service as to the Lord and not men, not to men. What he says there, not with eye service, that means the same thing you used to do when you were a kid when mom and daddy were watching, you did what you were supposed to do. But as soon as they turned their back, you went and did what you wanted to do that was contrary to what they were wanting you to do. Paul says, don't do that. If you're a servant, if you're a slave, when you're serving your master, you serve your master just as if you're serving Christ. Those are not my words. That's what the Apostle Paul said. Serve your master as though you're serving Christ. And he tells us why. Because you're doing it unto the Lord and not unto men. Verse 8, knowing that whatsoever good thing any man doeth, the same shall he receive of the Lord, whether he be bond or free. Paul says, if you're a servant, if you're a slave, obey your master and do your best to serve them just as if you were serving Christ. Knowing that if you do it with the right spirit and to the best of your ability, God will acknowledge that and give you the blessing just for having done what was right.
That's what Joseph did, didn't he?
That is what Joseph did.
He worked so hard as if he were working for God for those slave owners. He was a slave.
That's right.
But God rewarded him.
Brother Mike, it gives a perfect example right out of the Bible. Joseph in the Old Testament. He was first a slave to Potiphar. Then he was
a servant in the prison.
Yeah, a servant in the prison. And then he became the number two man in all of Egypt, just because of being the right kind of servant in the worst possible of circumstances. Was he serving a believer as his master? No. I assure you, Potiphar was not
a believer.
Neither was Pharaoh. That's right. But he served them as if he was serving God and tried to be obedient just as he would be obedient to God. And God blessed him because of it. Good example, Brother Mike.
Even Pharaoh didn't try to get him to do the things that were against his principles as a believer in the Lord.
Well, I think Pharaoh got...
He was a tribe. I mean, he realized somebody that he's serving has got more power than he does.
I think Pharaoh learned something from Joseph. You're right. I agree with that. Yes, sir?
I'll say that to me, Joseph was showing the relationship he had with his father and his mother. I think he learned that obedience and service from the Mark as he took a boy from his daddy and his mama. He's showing his parents well, okay?
I think you're right, Brother Mike. He was honoring his father and mother. All right, now look what Paul says as he addresses the masters in verse number 9. And ye masters, do the same things unto them, that is unto the servants. Forbearing threatening, knowing that your master also is in heaven, neither is there respect of persons with him. So Paul says, don't threaten your servant, don't threaten your slave, treat him well. Be kind to him, in other words. And he says, the reason you should do that is because you have a master too. He might not be here on earth, but you have a master in heaven. And he doesn't care who's the master and who's the slave here on earth. He's no respecter of persons. So what that tells us is we all, no matter where we are here on this whiteboard, we all have a master that's in heaven. And we're all going to give account to that master. So what's important to me should not be what other people think, but what God thinks about my actions, my attitude.
Do what you're supposed to do. And you're going to go
there. That's exactly right. Do what I'm supposed to do to please the master in heaven. These other people will be happy too if I do that, but he's the one I'm supposed to be pleasing. So his command to the masters was to treat the slave well. But did he say to the masters, listen, if you're a Christian, if you're a believer, free all your slaves. Do away with slavery. Advocate for the abolition of slavery. Did he say any of that? No. John Brown can teach or preach or say whatever he wants to do. Today he's saying it from the pits of hell. But John Brown's message that he preached in 1850 was wrong. Slaves did not have an obligation to rebel and murder their masters then, nor that do they now have that command. What God said was for masters to treat your servants, your slaves, as brothers. Treat them well. And servants, slaves, don't seek to overthrow the master. Just be in obedience to them and serve them well, just as you're serving Christ. Because we all have a master to whom we're accountable. Now, before we finish the rest of the chapter here, I want to stop and say this. Growing up as a son of the South, we all hear from everything that comes out nowadays from New York, Hollywood, or Washington that the South was evil because we had slaves in the South. The reality is every civilization that has ever existed on the face of the earth has had slaves. The South was not unique. In fact, what you also may not know, because they sure don't teach it in the history books, there was not one slave that was ever brought to Dixie that came on a southern ship to America. All of the slave traders from these United States were from New England.
That's where the ships were made, too.
And that's where the ships were made. That's right, Brother Mike. Some of those families from New England who made it wealthy by importing slaves and selling them in the South are some of the predecessors to the same politically connected families that still run the country from up north in New England. And the reason they were selling most of the slaves in the South, most of them, not all of them, is because the type of agriculture in the South was more conducive to using slaves for large plantations or large farms than the farming that was done for the most part up north. There were about 3.5 million slaves in the South in 1860. But did you know there were also approximately 500,000 slaves in the North in 1860?
Ulysses Grant's family owned slaves.
That's right. Grant's family owned slaves. His wife inherited them from her father. Did she free them? Nope, she didn't free them. She just kept them after inheriting them. Lincoln's family? So, yeah, that's what I was saying. That's right. So another thing that's not told as part of the story is that, you know, Mr. Lincoln supposedly freed the slaves during the war with the Emancipation Proclamation. But the reality is, if you read the Emancipation Proclamation, it did not free one single slave. It only supposedly freed the slaves in the southern states that they were still at war with. Well, the federal government didn't have any control over the states they were still at war with, but the slaves that they had supposedly come to free, when the Union armies came through, they did not free those slaves. They became the property, and that's what the government documents still show. They became the property, the chattel property of the federal government, and Mr. Grant and Mr. Sherman and others put them to work for the Union Army involuntarily against their will. So it just transferred ownership of the slave from the southern planter to the federal government. And could I hasten to say that the offspring of those people remain slaves to that new master to this very day, and that's part of the reason they're still in bondage today.
Different plantation.
We're all on the plantation now.
There was also a theory I heard about on the military channel a while back. It'd be about manpower, like we'd have 10,000 Union troops fighting 10,000 Southern troops, and in anticipation of any slave revolt because of the Emancipation Proclamation. When that happened, that same 2,500 Southern troops would be withdrawn from the battlefield. That would mean less Southern troops for the Yankees to fight. So there was also, I hate to say it, cold-blooded, practical method to it. That was just theoretical. Nobody's really ever proved it.
Sure. And by the way, there were colored troops that fought for the South, too. And there were certainly plenty of opportunities for slaves in the South, had they wanted to have risen up and revolted, rebelled, killed whoever was left around because all the men were gone off to war.
And if anybody got killed, it'd be considered what we know nowadays called collateral damage.
But the slaves in the Old South mostly viewed themselves as part of the families with whom they worked and lived. Contrary to what Hollywood would have you to believe and the History Channel would have you to believe, most Southern slaves were not mistreated. If for no other reason they weren't mistreated, because if you have someone who's working for you and you beat them, they're not going to do very much work for you. They're not going to be able to do very much work for you. For the most part, Southern slaves were treated just like the other common Southerners across the South. In the 1930s, during the FDR's New Deal, part of his plan to help give jobs to people during the Great Depression, in order to employ writers that were out of work, he had produced, or the federal government had produced, something called the slave narratives. You can still find them in bookstores today. You can even find excerpts from them online. The slave narratives, this is the 1930s, so that's about 60 or 70 years after the war was already over with, but there were still some blacks alive across the country who had been slaves or grown up in slave families when they were children, because they were old enough to have lived through that. In the interviews that were done with those former slaves, 90% of those say nothing but good things about their former masters and the families for whom they lived and worked. There are even very interesting stories where some of the slaves from time to time would loan money to their masters for different things. Why? Because in the Old South, as it's recorded in the book by Dabney entitled In Defense of Virginia, the Southern view of slavery was the biblical view of slavery. And that is that they did not view themselves as owning the person, they viewed themselves as owning the labor of that person. Might be involuntary labor, but they believed they had a right to the labor of the person that they had paid for. And so Southerners in general did not believe they owned the person. They believed they owned that person's involuntary labor. And so the slaves would be obligated to work 8, 10, however many hours for the master in the fields or in the blacksmith shop or whatever they did. But then at the end of the day, whatever that slave did with their free time was up to them. They could do what they wanted to, and they could even grow their own crops, make their own products, and sell them. And the money they made from that belonged to the slave. There are numerous accounts of slaves actually buying their own freedom because they saved up enough money working in the evenings or whatever to do that. So I say all of this because we are beaten up in the South because we had slaves. Did you know that in the Old South,
we had more slaves than the North. Both of us had slaves. That's all.
The Old South was the only place in the history of the world where black African slaves were imported, and instead of dying out and having to be replenished regularly, they grew by leaps and bounds numerically. Why? Because in the Old South, they were not treated the way it's been portrayed on the History Channel and in Hollywood, by and large. I'm not saying there weren't some cases that were wrong, but Southerners had a biblical view of slavery. And the biblical view of slavery is not that there shouldn't be slavery. The biblical view of slavery is that if you're going to have slaves, here's how you have to treat them. And that was the Southern view of slavery. Jerry?
The North didn't free them as such as the South had, because the South frees them after they had done their time as a slave, but they have their rights here. They don't have rights even after they get out of the North. We had the cavalry that was all black. I think men from Alabama, as free, you know, free from being slaves, that joined in and successfully for 1 year as a cavalry from the leader, it's all black, carrying sabers, and the North didn't like that. But I'm going to tell you what.
Well, let me just stop you right. Let me stop you right there, Jerry, just for time's sake. What Jerry's saying is true, because even in the northern states, after the war was over and after slavery had been abolished by the 13th Amendment, there were numerous northern states who would not even allow freed blacks to live within their state. Illinois, from which Abraham Lincoln supposedly hailed, was one of those. You can read the black codes in the northern state of Illinois. Any freed black that was there more than 30 days would be beaten or imprisoned and kicked out of the state and not allowed to come back, because they were the ones treating blacks differently than they were treated throughout the South. There are many other things that I could say in defense of the South and the Southern view of slavery that I don't have time to go into, but let me just assure you that the picture you've been given of slavery in the Old South is not at all what the accurate picture is. Southerners in general had a biblical view of slavery, of slaves, and of slave masters. And I think that's where I want to stop for tonight. We're not going to finish the rest of the chapter because the last part of chapter 6 deals with the whole armor of God and fighting spiritual warfare. I don't want to cram that into just a few minutes, and I don't want to keep you too overtime tonight. So we'll have one more Sunday evening of the book of Ephesians. We'll do that when we come back, Lord willing, week after next. Any other questions before we knock off tonight? Questions or comments?